Word of mouth.
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 Word of mouth. Word of
mouth. Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's a perfect day for Herbstlaubtrittvergnügen, German for kicking through piles of autumn leaves, literally translated from autumn foliage strike fun. Or Geheimgangsverlockung, the conviction that all large houses must have secret passages. Those are a couple of newly minted German words. For those who ever thought, there should be a German word for that, shouldn't there? Well, now there is, courtesy of Ben Schott, author of Schott's Miscellanies and Annual Almanacs that have sold millions and have been translated into more than a dozen languages. Now, he's completed a kind of translation of his own, a compendium of compounds to describe the inexpressible. It's called Schottenfreude, German words for the human condition. And Ben Schott, great to have you back with us on Word of Mouth.
Guten Tag.
Guten Tag, indeed. Well, Ben, is this where English fails us? We don't have a word to describe instinctively curling up your toes in mortification at someone else's embarrassment, for example?
Oh, you mean Fussfaust.
Wow.
It's interesting. English seems to turn to German in moments when we're perplexed, embarrassed, or unable to describe certain emotions. So everything from the commonplace angst to the more unusual Schadenfreude. Schadenfreude is experiencing pleasure at other people's misfortune. Now, there's no word in English, but Schadenfreude seems to be the perfect German word. So English has borrowed these German loan words for these strange emotions and sensations.
So these compounds can often be of many syllables. Can you pronounce all of them?
I can pronounce, yes, most of them. There's 120 words in the book. There's two or three that I find very difficult. But I'm proud to say I can pronounce the longest, which is Karfesteugs Innenaufstattungs Neugeruchsgenuss, which, as I'm sure your listeners will know, is the German for new car smell.
Well, you have references for all of these words in the entries. Now, why describe this, which I do believe is a particular flavor of air freshener? You can get new car smell air freshener, I think.
The new car smell was something of a joke. I like the idea of creating an incredibly long compound word for something that was very easy to say. But some of them are German words to describe things that really aren't easy to say. So we have, you know, a whole series. You mentioned one before, which is Herbstlaubtrittvergnügen, the joy of kicking through autumn leaves. But it's also, in a stepping way, there's Leertretung. Leertretung, which is literally void stepping, is when you step down heavily on a stair that isn't there in the dark, and you feel totally like your world's been turned upside down, like gravity's been switched off, and you feel very stupid. That sensation is Leertretung.
Let's hear some of these words pronounced by someone who isn't me from the Op Art podcast on New York Times Opinion Pages, where you are a frequent guest. Some of the words from Schadenfreude being pronounced by Dr. Oscar Bantlau. I guess it was a collaborator of yours, yes?
Absolutely.
Let's hear a few.
Mundphantom.
Feeling that the thermometer is still under your tongue after it's been removed.
Seigarnik Frustration.
The gnawing sense of incompleteness, knowing there is a partially eaten snack lying around.
Dornhöschenschlaf.
Feigning sleep to avoid unwanted sexual intimacy.
I have to say, they are so fun to listen to and so fun to try and say, even if I'm getting it absolutely wrong.
Well, there are some that are incredibly inherently pleasing. One of them, I wanted to create a word for that feeling, that instinctive knowledge of the thing that gave you food poisoning. You know, you're there, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and you go, it was the salmon mousse. It was the oysters. And so we came up with Bauchgefühl, Bauchgefühl, which is literally gut feeling, gut feeling.
Give us a little background on that, though. You know, how do you determine need for these kind of words? You have a little note here that the travel site TripAdvisor has more than 26,000 reviews mentioning food poisoning, many of which illustrate that people know exactly what made them sick.
Well, the idea of creating these words started with finding a void for a word. So it literally happened on a car journey in 2008 when I was with my wife. And I said, you know, isn't it bizarre that the journey on the way back always seems so much shorter than the journey on the way there? And I said, there should be a German word for that. I bet there's a German word for that. And I emailed my friend Oscar, who helped me with the book. He's a professional Bavarian, so he knows what he's talking about. And he said, well, there isn't, but I could construct one. So he constructed this absurd polysyllabic word. And that idea stuck with me, because German is a language that you can create these compounds, and it does all the time, everything from doppelganger to, I don't know, a rucksack, for example. And so what I wanted to do was create new compounds for words which didn't exist, but sensations that we really felt as part of the human condition.
So what did you do? Keep track of words that you wanted something, some way to describe the ineffable, and came up with them?
Absolutely. I kept track of, I have a list of several hundred words that I thought needed to exist. And some of them are absurd, and some of them are more serious. For example, Unsterblichkeit, Todd, sums up the intimations of mortality when your last surviving parent dies. And anyone who's experienced this will know there's this tremendous sense that it's now your turn, that somehow, you know, the ceiling of your parents has been removed and it's just, you know, you and eternity. So Unsterblichkeitstod is a pretty dark German word for a pretty dark human experience. So they're not all frivolous, and some of them really plumb what I hope are the depths of, you know, everyday life.
Why do you think German is the language for this?
Well, I think it is technically possible, because you can create these compounds in a way that you can't in English without making puns, which are always sort of lighthearted. And partly, I think it's something to do with the sort of Middle European past. So I think it's the fact that, you know, Freud wrote in German, you have Freud and Jung, you have the birth of psychoanalysis, you also have writers and thinkers like Schopenhauer and Nietzsche. There's something about that culture that seems sort of elegantly introspective, unlike maybe Italian, which may sound more poetic, or English, which I think is funnier and more glib. German has a depth and a seriousness that is useful to describe serious things and quite amusing when it's describing frivolous things.
Tell me again the word for instinctively knowing what gave you food poisoning.
Bauchgefühl, Bauchgefühl.
Now, I want to note that you said it was the salmon mousse. The exact same culprit as in The Meaning of Life,
Monty Python's Meaning of Life.
Okay, so where are you getting these sources from? I see in the press notes it says Justin Bieber, Groucho Marx. Where does Justin Bieber come into this?
Well, actually, seeing you ask, and I'm not sure you want to have this on your radio show, there is a word which is fishneedling, which is bestowing nicknames on your sexual parts or the sexual parts of another, which some lovers, I am told, do. And I have two references to this, because every word has references, times in the past, historically, philosophically, where writers have described these things. So this, the bestowing nicknames on your genitals, there are two sources. One is from D.H. Lawrence, Sons and Lovers, which is a very serious highbrow, and the other is Justin Bieber, whose fans nicknamed his manhood Jerry. So it depends whether you want highbrow or lowbrow, but if you're doing it to your bits or the bits of your lover, then there is a serious cultural reference that you can touch upon.
Okay, well, so we do, I think, frequently use doppelganger or Gesundheit, certainly, Zeitgeist, but do you really expect people are going to pick these up and start using Einzi July? That's the melancholy of cooking for one.
The lonely kettle, yes. The answer is I don't know. I think some of them are catchy and short enough that might get picked up. I mean, for example, Leerteitung or Betrug, which I mentioned, possibly. Some of them are just joyful and absurd. But this book, Schadenfreude, is also bizarrely coming out in Germany, in German. So there is a German edition. This is completely and utterly glorious. Knaus, the German publishers, have bought the German rights and they translated it back into German. So this book now exists in Germany, and I'm told there are people who aren't quite certain how much these words have been made up and how much they're real. So I'm hoping an elaborate confusion arouses and these words just sort of enter into the ether, into the zeitgeist even.
Well, Benchart, you design all of your own books, right? And which are more sort of objects than books. So how do you expect this to be used? I mean, coffee table passed around as gifts, what?
Well, frankly, as long as they're read, I don't really mind how they're used. It's a long, thin hardback. It's a strange shape because some of the words are very long and Germanic. And as you sort of hinted, there are the German words, mm-hmm. but then on the left-hand page, there are these very, very detailed footnotes. So I try and really go back and really explore the facts. Say, for example, the word Kissenkühler Labsal, which is one of my favorites. It is literally cool pillow refreshment, and it describes the joy, the ineffable joy of turning a cold pillow in the middle of the night and resting your head on it, that wonderful sense of chill and relief. Now, this has been described by some remarkable writers, including Goethe and Proust. So this sensation that you might have tonight goes back, has been described for hundreds of years by amazing writers. And it's that sense that nothing we experience is new. All of these sensations are something old and traditional and have a past and now have a German word.
Ben Schott, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Ben Schott, best-selling author of Schott's original Miscellany and its three sequels, the annual Schott's Almanac, and his latest book, Schottenfreude, German Words for the Human Condition. You can find a link to find more about the book on our website, wordofmouthradio.org, or on Facebook or Twitter.
We're all gonna be like three little Fonzies here. And what's Fonzie like?
Cool.
What?
Cool.
Correctamundo. And that's what we're gonna be. We're gonna be cool.
The pursuit of cool has preoccupied our culture for decades. It may have started as an American quest to spread around the globe. Now everybody wants to be cool. And therein lies the rub. To be cool is to be indifferent to status and have an effortlessness that would be instantly destroyed by appearing to try too hard. Slate magazine just wrapped up a month-long series on the nature of cool in 2013. Dan Coyce is senior editor at Slate and a contributor to the series that looked at the history and future of what we define as the ineffable but instantly recognizable concept of cool. Dan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
Just listening to Miles Davis's 1957 album, The Birth of the Cool. So he named it. But where did the cool actually originally come from, the word and the concept?
Well, it, of course, originally referred to the temperature, right? It referred to not warm, not hot, not cold, but just cool. It's climatic moderation, you know? But that, of course, is tied into the way we think of cool now. You're not too hot, you're not too cold. You're right on the level. You're cool. You're cool with whatever. And by the time of Shakespeare in A Midsummer Night's Dream, it was already being used to refer to sort of a moderation of emotion, a moderation of tone. Theseus tells Hippolyta, lovers and madmen have such seeming brains, but such shaping fantasies that apprehend more than cool reason ever comprehends.
Hmm.
But by the 20th century, of course, it meant not just a moderation of your emotions, but it meant a whole attitude, a whole posture. And that came, it seems to our writers and to most historians, that it came from African-American culture and then moved its way into sort of the majority monoculture to mean something more than just being okay with stuff, but having a certain je ne sais quoi about you that others might try to aspire to.
Which is so interesting, looking at, especially in the 1920s, certainly, when some of the first blues songs, cool, kind, daddy blues, and that kind of thing were coming up in American popular culture. This was an era rife with, you know, lynchings, with riots against African Americans. So they become the standard bearers of cool, while the most maligned population. What's going on there?
Well, there were sort of two parallel cultures happening at this time, right, in America, which is that the vast majority of the monoculture was discriminatory towards blacks and excluded them from society, but within sort of a certain area of, I guess you could call it early hipsterdom, that was where the cachet was. That society was what a certain class of people attempted to emulate. You know, and so there's always been a tradition of popular culture moving from the outside into the inside, right? And it happens even today. You know, the way that mainstream America deals with, you know, sex and drugs and anything that was once a lot more difficult for the mainstream to handle is now a lot different. And that's because things move from the outside to the inside. And this was just the beginning of that process, was the jazz and the fashion and the attitudes of a certain otherwise ostracized population were nevertheless moving their way into the mainstream.
Mm. We saw beat culture, later hippie culture, white people appropriating this kind of idea of cool. Looking from 2013 backwards, as you and so many other people on your staff did, what makes something cool?
Well, the easiest explanation of it, and one that doesn't really encompass everything about Cool, but is sort of a great shorthand of looking at it, was Seth Stevenson's, which is not fully appropriate for radio, but is just not giving a darn, right? You know, it, simply not caring what other people think of you. And his example is Prince, right? Prince clearly does not give 12 darns, as Seth says slightly more vulgarly in our pages. He doesn't care what you think about him, and so he will wear purple frilly, ruffly whatevers. But it doesn't matter because he's so amazing. He's so cool that he can get away with it. There's that aspect of cool. Then there's the aspect of cool, which is simply sort of aesthetic, minimal elegance, right? You know, Mark Joseph Stern for this series wrote a great piece declaring the coolest thing that anyone has ever worn, the coolest fashion item that has ever been worn. And he declared that it was Cary Grant's sunglasses in North by Northwest because they're a little bit awkward as a fashion object. They're a little bit big. They have these sort of weird green lenses, but he wears them so effortlessly and perfectly, and they work so well with his look and the image that he puts forth in that movie. He wears them in the train scene when he's seducing Ava Marie Saint, that they, by that nature, become sort of the epitome of coolness, of mid-century coolness that people are still trying to evoke today.
You feel you've seen me somewhere before?
Mm-hmm.
Funny how I have that effect on people. It's something about my face.
It's a nice face.
You think so?
I wouldn't say it if I didn't.
Oh, you're that type.
What type?
Honest.
The sunglasses are part of a sort of toolkit, you know, the dangling cigarette, the leather jacket, you know, I'm thinking of Marlon Brando or James Dean. But it's interesting that the idea and concept of cool has endured. But we don't say, you know, what a swell bunch of fellows, you know, or groovy,
right,
or dope. But we still say cool. Why has that lasted?
Well, that's a totally hep question, you know. It's lasted, I think, because it's flexible enough to be updated, you know, from era to era. You know, the rebel cool of Marlon Brando is not exactly the same as the funk cool of the 70s, but they share a certain attitude. They share a certain sort of spirit. In the same way, the term is flexible enough to be sort of appropriated in the 90s and in this century by the tech world.
We're speaking with Dan Coyce, senior editor at Slate Magazine. He's a contributor and has been working on this series, a month-long series about cool and what it means now in 2013, looking at aspects of fashion and attitude and dance. And you, as you just mentioned, technology, internet and social media expose things much faster and wider than culture has ever been able to move. So how long is it possible for something to stay cool?
It seems like you can measure it in seconds for many things, you know, and it sort of depends on your perspective. If you are 23 and you live in Brooklyn, then Haim, you know, the band Haim, was cool in June. But they're already not cool anymore. But whereas if you're me, a 38-year-old guy in the suburbs, Haim just started being cool like yesterday.
Well, that's part
but
of
But I'm hopelessly uncool for thinking so.
But that's kind of the catch-22, right? That coolness wears off as soon as everybody else recognizes it. You can be wearing, like, skinny jeans tucked into boots, and that's cool, and then they're selling it at the Limited. Do you know what I mean? Or everyone's wearing it at the mall, and it's no longer cool.
Right. Well, it's even more than just when you recognize it. It's like the second I wear skinny jeans, they're no longer cool. And so I think that's sort of the fun of exploring this, is trying to understand why it is that something moves from cool to uncool while it has differing levels and has a differing evolution throughout its life. And, you know, that makes it, if you are really a cool hunter, right, if that is something that you want in your life, that makes it a real challenge to stay up to date. On the other hand, you can also argue that if you explicitly are a cool hunter and definitively want that in your life, you are by definition uncool. Mm-hmm. Cary Grant wasn't trying to be cool. He just was cool. Prince isn't trying to be cool. He just is cool. if you're trying that hard, forget it, man. You're totally uncool.
Well, and you're also pointing out something that it is not a permanent state, you know, because it does evolve.
Yeah.
I mean, John Travolta as Tony Manero in Saturday Night Fever, cool. John Travolta dancing with Uma Thurman in Pulp Fiction, what do you think there?
Oh, that's still cool. That was like a reborn cool.
All right, how about Battlefield Earth?
Right, John Travolta showing up at a premiere now, not cool. But we can still look back at those and see and experience their cool again, even with, you know, the ephemeral nature of that in the forefront of our minds. We know that John Travolta is no longer cool. But you can still watch that scene in Saturday Night Fever and be swept up in it enough to understand how amazing that seemed in 1979. You know, I can understand why people looked at that and said, oh, man, I want to be like that.
We just washed the hair. You know, I work on my hair a long time, and you hit it. He hits my head.
Earlier on, you said, you know, cool, not trying too hard is the sort of capsule definition. Maybe that's something we've known for a long time. What have you learned while working on this series? What's been explored and revealed to you?
I would say my favorite exploration that we've had in this series was a really forceful defense of the coolness of being deliberately uncool. David Greenwald wrote it for us. And his argument was that the constant churn and ephemeral nature of coolness and the constant battle to keep up with it that so many people are participating in all the time. It's just a trap. You know, it just means, as he wrote, that you're succumbing to whatever peer-reviewed focus group that you are subscribing to, even if it's the cool kids, you're still just following the herd. Mm. And so if the real coolness in the world is doing what feels right to you and not caring what other people think, then you should free yourself to, you know, love as David Greenwald does, to love not only Haim, but also, you know, emo rockers like Paramore or sort of mainstream country like Casey Musgraves. Find the things that you like and follow your arrow, as Casey Musgraves sings, wherever it goes, and embrace your uncoolness, because in that direction lies true satisfaction, and really, you could make an argument, true cool.
Dan Coy, senior editor at Slate Magazine, where you will find Cool Story. It's a series of articles, interactive features, and slideshows exploring the elusive nature of what it means to be cool. And Dan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
You can find a link to the series and listen to a cool versus uncool quiz that I played with Dan after our interview at wordofmouthradio.org, on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio, or on Twitter, at Word of Mouth. And we'll leave you with the song The Wire by Haim, a trio of Jewish sisters whose indie rock band may or may not be cool right now, depending on where you live.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. 4 years after the 2008 presidential election, the name Bill Ayers remains somewhat radioactive. In a new memoir, Ayers recalls the April evening when his name was first invoked as a barometer for patriotism. A group of students was visiting. One turned on the debate between Democratic nominees. Moderator George Stephanopoulos turned to candidate Barack Obama and said,
on this issue, general theme of patriotism in your relationships, a gentleman named William Ayers, he was part of the Weather Underground in the 1970s. They bombed the Pentagon, the Capitol, and other buildings. He's never apologized for that. And in fact, on 9/11, he was quoted in the New York Times saying, "I don't regret setting bombs. I feel we didn't do enough." An early organizing meeting for your state Senate campaign was held at his house, and your campaign has said you're friendly. Can you explain that relationship for the voters and explain to Democrats why it won't be a problem.
Georgia,
Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident is Ayers' record of becoming what he calls a punching bag during that campaign. In the book, Ayers owns up to his activities as a, quote, unrepentant terrorist, and writes about being the target of a multi-million dollar campaign to demonize him. He recalls the hate mails, the death threats, and canceled lectures with spirited prose and a surprising sense of humor. And Bill Ayers joins us now from Chicago. Bill, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia. Happy to be here.
Fill out that scene for us in 2008 when you heard your name in that debate.
Well, you know, in some sense, we knew something like that might be coming because as candidate Obama became more and more viable, it seemed inevitable that something that had been percolating in the fever swamps of the right wing would move toward the mainstream. And of course, George Stephanopoulos was more or less doing Hillary Clinton's bidding in that debate and raised this question. For me, sitting at home, you know, I'd had my graduate students over, we'd had a potluck, someone turned it on, and a few minutes into it, the clip you just played came over our television. And I have to say, my students absolutely were dumbfounded. Several dropped to the ground, holding their hands over their eyes. One young woman turned to me and said, "Can you believe it? He has the same name as you." And one of the other students said, "That's because it's the same guy. This is Bill, the same guy." And the odd thing about that night, of course, was that suddenly broadcast into the country and the world was this narrative that turns out, I think, to be quite a false narrative. But my students, who kind of knew me quite well minutes before they heard this, now felt like they didn't know me at all. Yeah. And I felt kind of the same way. I felt a little bit out of body myself. But it turned out that this narrative that Hillary Clinton developed, the idea that Obama was a mystery man and that we didn't know anything about him, but he had these shady friends, Jeremiah Wright, the preacher in the south side of Chicago, Rashid Khalidi, and me, and then tried to string this idea that guilt by association would rule the day. The interesting thing is it didn't work for Senator Clinton and it didn't work for McCain Palin.
So Public Enemy, your new memoir, this follows fugitive days covering your time on the lam in the 1970s especially. So this is the true narrative? Is that what you meant to do with this book?
Well, you've highlighted in the opening of this the kind of, the demonization and the craziness of the 2008 campaign, but that's really a relatively small part of the book. I really try to pick up where Fugitive Days left off, and Fugitive Days is the story of a young man, myself, in full-throated opposition to the Vietnam War, and it covers the years 1965 to 75. So this book picks up where that book left off, and it opens in the 2008 campaign, but then it goes back. And the question that it raises is similar to the question raised in the first book, which is, how does one live a life that doesn't make a complete mockery of your values, what you believe? Public Enemy, this book, is much more about teaching and parenting and being a university professor than it is anything much more dramatic than that.
We do learn about your family, your dedication to your community, your relationship with your students, and your wife, Bernadine Dorn. You and Bernadine were on the lam for a decade, and then you decide to turn yourselves in Chicago in 1980. Why did you make that decision?
Well, it was a decision that took longer than it probably should have, but the Vietnam War ended, and that turned out to be the reason for the existence of the organization we were part of. And with the organization gone, it just seemed more sensible after a while. We had two little kids at the time to turn ourselves in, to get straight with the law, to resolve our legal problems. Bernadine had some charges against her. We resolved those. They were charges like resisting arrest, the kind of typical charges from street demonstrations. She was given probation and a fine, and we went back to New York and resumed our work as, in my case, a teacher, in her case, a legal advocate worker on juvenile justice. A couple years later, after the Brinks robbery in Nyack, New York, we ended up adopting a 14-month-old child who was the child of Kathy Boudin and David Gilbert. And at that point, she was called to a grand jury to testify, you know, about that incident. She had nothing to do with it. She knew nothing about it. She thought it was a dreadful action. But she was called before a grand jury, and she felt, as a matter of principle, that she could not talk to the grand jury. And so she was then put in federal lockup. And we were very fortunate. We got her out in, I think, 7 or 8 months.
And just to fill that out, the Brinks robbery was in 1981, after you'd already turned yourselves in. This was involved several Weather Underground members. Two police officers and a Brinks guard were killed in
that
incident.
Yeah, it was people, that's right, and the people who were involved were people who had once been in the Weather Underground and had once been in the Black Liberation Army, the Black Panther. Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing here, Bill, is that Bernadine Dorn, your wife, worked with Michelle Obama. She was the one who was on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. Were there times after your name became the black mark on the family when you thought, why me, not her?
Oh, I did. Absolutely. I thought it all along. I mean, she's, if it were me, I'd have chosen the better looking, smarter, more terrific person. But, you know, we thought it was kind of mildly ridiculous and sexist, and no one knows why it happened. Barack Obama and I did sit on a couple of boards together. We did know him as a person around the neighborhood, as he knew us. So, it wasn't what it was kind of projected as. And I guess I'd say one more thing about that, which is that Barack Obama said all during the campaign, I'm a moderate, pragmatic, middle-of-the-road politician. And the right wing looked at him and said, no, he's a secret socialist, secret terrorist, secret Muslim, pals around with these bad people. And the left wing looked at him and said, he's winking in my direction. Mm-hmm. But he wasn't winking. He was exactly who he said he was, a moderate, middle-of-the-road, pragmatic Democrat.
In your book, you mentioned that Obama referred to your past actions as detestable several times throughout that campaign. What about that word to you? Did that sting? I mean, you are indeed unrepentant about the work that you did with the Weather Underground.
Well, what the Weather Underground did definitely crossed lines of legality. It definitely crossed lines, perhaps, of common sense. And so it doesn't strike me as completely bizarre to call those actions detestable. On the other hand, I think there's a reason that the Vietnam War continues to stimulate in us anguish, anger, confusion, disagreement. And that's because we haven't come to terms with the reality of what this country did for 10 years in Vietnam. We haven't spoken truthfully about it. And when we've tried to speak truthfully about it, it has been washed away. So I was arrested opposing the war in Vietnam initially in 1965. I was arrested many times over the next 3 years in nonviolent direct action protest. In 1968, a majority of the people had been won to oppose the war, but we couldn't end it. So one of my brothers, for example, just to take one family, one of my brothers joined the Democratic Party and tried to build a peace wing. One of my brothers ran away to Canada. One went to the communes. And I did what I did. I don't think any of us were brilliant. I don't think any of us were leading. But I don't think any of us were crazy either. The situation was, every week the war dragged on, 6,000 innocent people were killed every week. There was no end in sight. How do you stop it?
We're talking with Bill Ayers, a name that generated a lot of noise during the 2008 election. He's written a memoir called Public Enemy. It's about his life as a parent, an educator, and a husband, and a dissenter since he and his wife came out of hiding in 1980. Well, Bill, your leadership in the Weather Underground earned you the title of domestic terrorist, a status that was invoked by then vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin at a 2008 rally.
Is someone who sees America as imperfect enough to pal around with terrorists who targeted their own country?
Sarah Palin there at a rally in 2008. You, of course, were the terrorist that Barack Obama was supposedly palling around with. And you received death threats. Universities tried to cancel your appearances due to a fear for student safety. Were you ever worried that somebody actually might follow through?
I didn't spend any time worrying about it. I mean, it's always a possibility, but I want to refuse to live my life as if, you know, I have to be in a barricaded situation. I think the threats that some universities got when I was scheduled to appear were mostly mythological, mostly, you know, a couple of angry guys with a couple of internet addresses. And I think that's really what it amounted to. I sometimes had pickets outside my talks, and sometimes I've gone out to talk to the people picketing. I do try to engage people, including the Tea Party, in dialogue because I think that's what we have to do. The reality is I was canceled at I'm still canceled at universities. But the more interesting thing to me is when either a university stands up or, as in the case of the University of Wyoming, when a student group sues the university and says, we don't care about his free speech, It's our free speech that's in danger if we're not allowed to bring controversial or, you know, outside the box thinking kind of people to campus. And in the Wyoming case, the students won, and I did go and give a talk, and the talk would have probably involved about 50 students before the big noise that was made about it. And when I finally got out there, 2,500 students came to hear me speak. I think they were a little disappointed when the guy who appeared on the stage was this old professor rather than some fire-breathing terrorist. But there it is. I am who I am.
You have maintained, Bill Ayers, that nobody died because of the Weather Underground's action. But three of your colleagues creating bombs did die.
That's correct. You know, and I write about that both in Fugitive Days and here in Public Enemy. That's a great, great sorrow, a great tragedy, the kind of feeling that'll never wash away. Three of our closest people, including my girlfriend, were killed in 1970 in a townhouse explosion.
That was the approach that you were taking to protest at the time. In the acknowledgments for this book, Public Enemy, you write, "I've never been more hopeful for young activists, the world around, for humanity, and for the future." I'm wondering what makes you hopeful now and how those tactics used in the 1960s, was there a failing of those tactics, and have we taken on a new method of protest?
I'm not a tactician, and I think tactics vary. But the most important thing is if you want to bring about real change, progressive change from the bottom up, it has to come from millions and millions of people changing the frame of their outlook on an issue or on several issues. I'm hopeful because young people today are smarter, more aware, more informed and engaged than ever before. And if you look at the kids from the Immigrant Youth Justice League, which was founded at the University of Illinois at Chicago, these are the kids who were undocumented and unafraid. Or you look at Occupy, and you can make fun of Occupy and throw stones at it, but the reality is they too changed the frame. Nobody was talking about the 1% and the 99% before Occupy. So they popularized a metaphor that really underlines income inequality. So I think all of these things are hopeful signs. And I think the crisis that we're facing, whatever we accomplished or failed to accomplish in the 60s, was prelude to the major crises we're facing now, including the life of the planet.
Well, we are, again, living in a divided country. You're a lifelong activist for social justice, an oppositional figure. People still cringe when they hear the name Bill Ayers. It evokes something. Would you like to be known as a divisive figure? Does that work for your brand of activism?
I'm not sure I buy into the assumptions that you're making. You say when my name is invoked, people cringe. Well, not the people I know. So I think, you know, you should be careful about kind of putting your pulse on the public mind. The public mind changes and goes through a lot of things. So I know that nobody wants to believe this today, but when Martin Luther King was assassinated, his positive public opinion rating was below George W. Bush's when he left office. So now we've created an image of Martin Luther King that's a saint. So we all love him now. But loving him when he was actually the angry pilgrim marching for justice and for peace was a little bit harder. So you say we live in a divided country. Yes, it was a divided country during slavery. Mm. It was a divided country during Vietnam. It was a divided country during the Black Freedom Movement. And sure, it's divided, but still we can persevere. Still we can plant our flags, and still we can change the frame and make a difference. And what we do or don't do will make a difference. That's why I think everybody should get busy, get out in the public square, say what they believe in, speak truth to power, and do the best we can.
Bill Ayers, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Virginia. Appreciate it.
Bill is the author of the memoir Fugitive Days, along with several books on education. Until his retirement, he was Distinguished Professor of Education and Senior University Scholar at the University of Illinois at Chicago. His new book is called Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident. And you can find links to more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Lucifer, Beelzebub, the Prince of Darkness. Some 70% of Americans believe in the existence of the devil by any other name. That's according to a 2007 Gallup poll, and that number has increased steadily since 1990, when only 55% believed in evil personified in the form of Satan. Now researchers are looking at the implications of belief in pure evil on psychological and social behaviors. Piercarlo Valdesolo is assistant professor of psychology at Claremont McKenna College and contributor to Scientific American's Mind Matters blog, where we found his article, The Psychological Power of Satan. Piercarlo, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Hi, Virginia. Thanks for having me.
First, a distinction. How do researchers working on these questions define evil, and how is that different from the concept of pure evil?
Right. So for the past 50 or 60 years, psychologists have been studying evil, and the definition that they typically adopt has something to do with intentionally trying to harm others and experiencing some amount of pleasure from doing so.
And how about the concept of pure evil? What does that mean?
So to most people, pure evil has some of those same elements, but it also has a couple of other important dimensions. The most interesting of which, at least to me, is this idea that someone who is pure evil is essentially evil. They cannot be changed. They're immutably evil to the point where they cannot be rehabilitated.
What kind of research has been done on the concept of the existence of pure evil, or maybe I should say the existence of the belief in pure evil and its implications?
So, well, actually, both are interesting questions, and most of the research in social psychology has dealt with the former. Right. So whether or not our idea of pure evil actually exists. So some of the original social psychologists were people who experienced firsthand the brutalities and atrocities of the Holocaust. And they were very interested in understanding why is it that people are behaving in these ways that look like pure evil. But they came to a very different conclusion. They concluded that it was something to do with the situation that they're in and not something to do with the malice that they have within their souls or their hearts. Belief in pure evil is something that's just more recently been researched. And these two papers that I talked about in the Scientific American article were some of the first to try and come up with a really good measure for people's beliefs in pure evil.
Does it tie in with this concept of sort of original sin, that we are born one way or another? I'm not sure.
That's probably right in cultures and religions that have this idea of original sin. But from a psychological perspective, we sort of ground it in this very general tendency to just understand other people's behaviors as a product of who they are, as a reflection of their true selves.
Well, for it to endure so long, there must be some appeal or payoff for people to embrace the worldview of pure evil. Any research tell us why people do?
That's an interesting question. So off the top of my head, I can come up with two different areas of research that might provide an explanation. One is that it is a more effective policing strategy in terms of sort of maintaining group cohesion and enforcing group norms to sort of come down hard on any violators. So to identify individuals who might be really bad is very, very important when it comes to establishing sort of functioning and cohesive societies. So being a little bit too zealous in terms of punishment would probably actually be a better strategy than to assume that someone's bad action isn't the result of pure evil. So the other reason, because of something called attributional complexity, the degree to which we take the time to think about the causes of other people's behaviors. Now, typically, as we go through our normal everyday lives, we don't really like to take the time to think about the causes of other people's behaviors. Sometimes we're not motivated to do so. Sometimes we're just not able to do so. So it's quicker to just kind of default to this view that the reason why someone behaves badly is because they're a bad person.
I want to get back to what you said about how we define belief in pure evil. You said that the research shows that someone who believes in pure evil is more likely to view somebody who has, say, committed a violent crime is unredeemable, immutable. How does that belief play out in terms of real-world consequences? How does it affect real behavior?
So in general, it influences our tendencies to seek redemptive violence. So this idea that violence is necessary for good to triumph over evil. So we see that our reactions to people who we think have caused us harm or caused others harm become more severe, both, you know, in terms of the prison population, but also just in terms of our everyday moral judgment. So if we're judging how wrong it was or how much someone should be punished for an act of theft or an act of assault, well, now we're much more punitive if we think or if we believe in this idea of pure evil.
How about on the other end of the scale, what I will call the Anne Frank belief, you know, that there is pure good in all people. It just gets corrupted. Anything, any research indicate that that thought might affect behavior in equally powerful ways?
Absolutely. And one of the studies that I talk about, conducted by researchers at Gustavus Adolphus College and Kansas State University, measured not only belief in pure evil, but belief in pure good. So that's exactly what you're suggesting here. And it does influence people's behaviors, these same kinds of punitive behaviors. If you believe in pure good, then when you're presented with a hypothetical case of someone who assaults someone else or someone who murders someone else, that they can be rehabilitated. And you're less likely to aggress towards them as severely as if you believed in pure evil. But it's not quite as strong. So belief in pure evil seems to be a stronger predictor of our responses to harm compared to belief in pure good.
Piercarlo, thank you for speaking with us today.
Sure thing. Thank you, Virginia.
Piercarlo Valdesolo, assistant professor of psychology at Claremont McKenna College and contributor to the Scientific American Mind Matters blog. His work has also been featured in the New York Times, Washington Post, and Boston Globe. And you'll find a link to his story from Scientific American called The Psychological Power of Satan. The link's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. War zones are one place that belief in pure evil can influence behavior. Anger, fear, and vengeance can lead otherwise ethical human beings to commit unspeakable acts. Military chaplains have provided spiritual advice and comfort to U.S. forces since before World War I. Bob Harley was an Army chaplain for 18 years, serving some of that time in Vietnam. He says his purpose was plain, to encourage everybody to keep their faith strong, even though they're in the midst of the most terrible thing that mankind can bring upon itself. In 2006, Bob's daughter Carol interviewed him about his experience for StoryCorps.
What was it like being a chaplain at war in Vietnam?
Well, I think chaplains have to have it firmly in mind who they are and what they're all about, and that they are there to encourage everybody to keep their faith strong, even though they're in the midst of the most terrible thing that mankind can bring upon themselves. You know, you talk about being with people on their spiritual journey. Well, when that journey is they've been seriously wounded, and they don't know whether they're going to live or die, and you're there working with them, that's where the challenge is really there. Do you have something worthwhile to say to somebody in their last moments? Many young men would be talking about their mothers. That's the most common experience of all, was that the blood would drain out, and as they would get weaker and go into shock, it's like regressing into childhood almost. It really does things to you to be there. And most of those men I had known at Fort Campbell before we ever left, and I knew their families. I knew that this first sergeant had five teenage boys back home, and he was shot by a sniper and killed. So those sorts of things really tend to drag you down. But you can't show depression, so you just kind of suck it up. And as long as I kept in mind that I was not there to be a cheerleader, to make the guys want to kill, kill, kill sort of thing, which is something that everybody seems to want, yeah, then I was all right.
That was Bob Harley, interviewed by his daughter Carol in 2006 for StoryCorps. Bob died a few months after the interview took place at 73. Thanks so much for spending some of your listening time with us today. If you like what you heard, you can pass it along. You can post segments on Facebook or Twitter or email them to friends. The links are easy to find on our Facebook page or at wordofmouthradio.org. We also invite you to share your ideas with us, the worthwhile blogs, the interesting reads, and upcoming events that have you talking. After all, the best stories are shared by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us again for more Word of Mouth next week from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Bill Barry,
and Zach Nugent.
Our intern is
James Pouliot.
Digital support from Rebecca Lavoie
and Sarah Plord.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. To subscribe to our podcasts and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth
is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.
Yeah.